Gemma. So today we'll take up one of the questions which morning we were discussing. That if one has to summarize Sri Aurobindo's teaching and practice, so what exactly it is in a very short summary. So fortunately for us, there is a letter of Sri Aurobindo which describes it. And primarily I'll be basing on that letter in his own words. First thing is that Sri Aurobindo's teaching derives itself from the ancient Vedic lore. And the ancient Vedic lore is first that there is one reality. And you may call it by any name, but there is one reality, and through many paths people approach it. This is the fundamental bedrock of Sri Aurobindo's teaching. The second aspect of it, that reality is not disconnected from this world. It has that element of transcendence. It transcends the world, but it is also connected with the world. So it's not the bridge that certain kinds of religious thought or even certain cults have created between the world and God. That was one of Sri Aurobindo's big both challenges, challenge to thought as well as challenge to the spiritual life, that can this gulf be bridged? So is our life here only a preparation for the afterlife, for a beyond? Or can this life become an expression of the higher spiritual life? So this is where we see the divergence. In India, there have been both these lines. In the Vedas, we see that they tried to aspire and make this world, earth and heaven, equal and one. So even our marriages were supposed to be the earth element and the heaven. So this was the original aspiration. But we see also another line which came out of the Vedas. So we had the other line which started turning into an otherworldly direction, that this world is Maya and there is the Brahman which is the reality. So, but there have been both seers as well as particularly powerfully Sri Krishna's own life. In fact, the life of avatars, where they have always tried to reconcile, bridge this world and the beyond. So this is where Sri Aurobindo belongs to that line, if I may say so, of the spiritual evolution of earth and mankind. Because both these things coexist. There are people who have taken an extreme flight into the beyond. There are others who have tried to reconcile it. So Sri Aurobindo belongs to that which reconciles this world and the beyond. So the third aspect is, so what really is this world seen from the divine point of view? From our point of view, it is bad, it is good, it is happy and sad, mixture of all that. It is suffering, dukkham, as the Buddha would call it. It is maya, as the illusionist would call it. So in Sri Aurobindo's thought, this world is a Leela of Vasudev. But this Leela means that there is a manifestation of the divine who is involved in this world. Meaning thereby the divine is both the apex and the seed, the base. So whatever we see in the world happening is the result of an evolution, progressive evolution of what is involved within it. So since the divine is involved within it, it is bound to at some point evolve the fullness of the divine, but in terms of matter. So this is the fundamental thing, that evolution is going on. And from there, the next logical thought comes, that is evolution over? He says no. So man is a transitional being and there is something which is going to come beyond man. And man is a half product between animal, a cross, as the Bible would say, cross between the animal and the gods. So something in us aspires to be godlike, to be divine, whatever term we call it, to make life beautiful, to make this world a world of joy and harmony. But there is in us also an animal part which drags us down, drags us back, drags a whole civilization back into the abysses. So we are a cross between the demigod and the beast, as Sri Aurobindo puts it in Savitri. A cross between the demigod and the beast. So this is where evolution stands today. But this is not the last product. It's very logical. Because if this is the last product of God's creativity, then we have to doubt or raise issues about. We know ourselves what we are. So here Sri Aurobindo brings in a very original but at the same time very logical thought, that evolution will go beyond man. And out of man will emerge the supramental being or the super divine superhumanity of the future, just as man has emerged out of the beast. So out of beast, certain human tendencies have emerged. And the logic of it is very simple, that if we look at the animal, higher animals, we can see certain human elements are emerging. For example, they feel sympathy, they feel kindness. Some of these higher animals, they can be very human-like in many of the responses. You know, cows and horses, dogs, even elephants. So they have this element which is emerging. In human beings, this element emerges fully. But then along with that, mind emerges. And Shobindu says, mind is a passage. Its purpose is to individualize. But beyond mind, there are higher ranges of consciousness towards which we are destined to evolve. And the sign of that is, just as in the animal we see a glimpse of a human beginning to emerge. I mean, I would add to that list curiosity of the monkey. So in humans, this constant aspiration which nags us for something which is greater, higher. So we are those incorrigible people who, despite all the appearances, want this world to become a better place. We don't know how. So sometimes we give up, sometimes we become cynics, which we should not, because if there is a divine logic or a divine consciousness behind, then however much we may tire, ultimately it will fulfill itself. There is a line in Savitri, a self-fulfilling transcendence waits above. So this other aspect is that man is a transitional being. Beyond man, there would be human beings who belong to a higher kind of humanity, not in a racist sense, but in terms of, they'll be more compassionate for that matter, more compassionate, more intuitive. Let's talk of these two main faculties. And automatically command power over the elements, power over the animal kind, their own animal nature. So that's the next step. And then this superhumanity, which is still human but with a changed consciousness. Shobindu has used the word superman for that. So beyond it will be the supramental humanity, or it will no more be humanity but a supramental being. So supramental being is someone where even the body undergoes a transformation. So these two steps are the ones which Shobindu and the mother came to ultimately fulfill for Earth. And for that, the reason they saw is that beyond mind there is a still higher range of consciousness, higher and higher ranges, and beyond these highest ranges there is the supramental consciousness. So it's only if that descends and starts operating. So it's like changing the operating system of the world, and if that begins to operate, then it will change. More and more people who open to it. So often a question is asked that, well, but what we see in the world is a lot of chaos. So that's because the old fixed order is being destroyed. Because unless you remove that old fixed order in which humanity was stuck thinking it is best. I mean, I look at it 50 years, 100 years back. Even our parents or their parents used to look upon, oh, our times was very good. But actually, if you really look closely, people were getting married. They were marrying their children so that they can have progeny. Can't call it a very good time. Or because you have grown up and you have the sexual urge, so you should biologically. So that was not a very good time. Look at women condition, look at many things. But that's a different subject. So there is a evolution next. So that fixed order is gone. So for a moment we'll see a kind of chaos, as we have been reading earlier. But this chaos is for a realignment towards a new order. So this is the whole logic of the supramental change. So this is the background. And with that, we will read this letter, which is a letter which, if I remember right, he wrote to perhaps the Maharani of Baroda, who had asked him, and he explains to her what this yoga is. It's called Sri Aurobindo's teaching and method of practice. The teaching of Sri Aurobindo starts from that of the ancient sages of India, that behind the appearances of the universe, there is the reality. Now, this reality, a lot of people speak about non-dualism and reality, but he explains that reality. That reality of a being and consciousness is self of all things, one and eternal. So in India, in Indian thought, in the Vedas, that reality is not just an impersonal reality, it is Satchidananda. So it is a being, it's true existence, it's conscious of itself, by its nature it's a being. But it's not the being of God as the religions have made it. That there is a Dadiwala Baba sitting out there who is busy with punishment and reward, no. But there is a being, and it's evident, because if there is a consciousness which is aware of itself, then by nature it's a being. That's how we know ourselves, by our own consciousness. So our consciousness is limited, so we know ourselves as limited beings. But the infinite consciousness knows itself as infinite being. All beings are united in that one self and spirit, but divided by a certain separativity of consciousness and ignorance of their true self and reality in the mind, life and body. So if you want to discover the secret of unity, it cannot come by interfaith dialogues, religious, political sloganism, or by ideological stands. It has to come only by a change of consciousness, discovery of the oneself. And that's the next step of spiritual evolution. When Mother was asked, how can we realize human unity? She said, by becoming conscious of the origin. So then all these fights between Hindu, Muslim, Christian, so often I say that you know, all religions have a date. But what was there before any religion? So there was the human aspiration. That's why the life divine begins with human aspiration. And that aspiration was planted in the human heart by the divine. So if you really look at it like that, you have to go back to that original divine consciousness and the divine self. This is the first part. Then the second passage is, Sri Aurobindo's teaching states that this one being, I think somebody is there, they can come in. Sri Aurobindo's teaching states that this one being and consciousness is involved here in matter. So involution literally means the tree becoming a seed. So the tree has compressed and condensed itself into a seed, or to use a computer analogy, a zip file. So that's involution. The entire data is enclosed in a small little chip. So the divine consciousness has put itself here in the form of a seed. And evolution is simply the unfolding of that seed. And we are midway through that unfolding. As simple as that. So there is a divine consciousness involved here. This is one of the new ideas which has been brought to the forefront by Sri Aurobindo. It's there in the Vedas, but Sri Aurobindo has developed it to a great extent. Because this is the key ultimately. If there is no involution, there would be no evolution. So we describe this world like a magic, out of magician's hat things are coming out. So you cannot explain evolution unless you talk about involution. It's not a magician's hat. And in such a methodical way. So evolution is the method by which it liberates itself. What liberates itself? The divine consciousness, which is locked within. Consciousness appears in what seems to be inconscient, and once having appeared, is self-impelled to grow higher and higher, and at the same time to enlarge and develop towards a greater and greater perfection. So first thing is that, you know, this involved consciousness evolves. So this idea, this is conscious, this not conscious, is a fiction of the human mind. So we can say that everything is conscious in a limited sense, or a greater sense, or to a still higher sense. That's the only truth. Like plants are conscious in their own little way, and if we go by what modern physics would say, we can equally say that there is consciousness involved even in atoms, even in electron. So consciousness is a whole continuum. It's the thread on which the pulse of forms are emerging. But it limits itself to a form. That's how Kathopanishad says, Agni Yathaiko Bhuvanam Pravishto Rupam Rupam Pratirupa Bhavugo, or Vayu Yathaiko Bhuvanam Pravishto. Now there is one Vayu, and it's all around, but it enters into a path or a vessel, it limits itself to that. So though Vayu in itself is powerful, it can literally, or water for that matter, this ocean can flood the whole earth, drown it. But it limits itself in a vessel. So it becomes limited, but it's the same water. So it can come out of it, expand and become one with that water and all its potential capacities, not just to dissolve into it, but that finite element in us can become one with the infinite, even in life. So that's what Isha Upanishad says. It speaks about vidyancha vidyancha yast dvedo bhayam saha. So it doesn't speak of dissolution in the one, but of the finite element receiving endlessly from the infinite. So in many of our stories, like the stories of Hanuman, you see that he is Vayuputra. So Hanuman, suddenly there is a release of the Vayu element and it can carry him very far. So Vayu is the element which comes just after space. So if you look at the hierarchy of things, so you have the ethereal, then the aerial, Vayu, and then you have Agni, then you have Jala, and then you have Earth, Prithvi. So because he is Pavanaputra and he can, that consciousness suddenly gets liberated in a moment of apocalypse. So he can do things which are seemingly impossible, but what is it that he cannot cross? And that's where the Indra's Vajra comes in, that is the space. So Indra is the guardian of, you know, the ultimate guardian. So though the story is shown in very, mythological form, but it basically, so when you liberate that element, but as human beings, we have the divine himself who can completely liberate, and it can take us to space and beyond space and time. So this is the second aspect of evolution. Life is the first step of the release, this release of consciousness. So living beings have a consciousness, a limited consciousness. They have a limited existence and they have a limited joy. So ananda. Mind is the second, but the evolution does not finish with mind. It awaits a release into something greater, a consciousness which is spiritual and supramental. So this is what gives hope in Sri Aurobindo's teaching. So the basis of hope is not any of the appearances. The basis of hope is that the divine is involved inside and the divine is playing with himself and releasing himself. So if you have to use the Hindi expression, we'll say kar lo baat. It doesn't depend on us, because evolution till now has been going on independent of us. And evolution will go on. The only difference, he'll point out, the next step of the evolution must be towards the development of supermind and spirit as the dominant power in the conscious being. So now he brings out the difference between evolution thus far and further. But while the former steps in evolution were taken by nature without a conscious will in the plant and animal life, in man, nature becomes able to evolve by a conscious will in the instrument. That conscious will is aspiration and faith. These are the two elements. And in a sense, as Sri Aurobindo starts in Synthesis of Yoga, very first chapter, he says, yoga, as Swami Vivekananda says, is concentrated evolution. We can equally add another word, concentrated and conscious evolution. So yoga, in one line, if one has to define, it's a conscious and concentrated evolution. Actually, if you look at it, it's the basis of all education. Why do we educate? We believe that we can become better. That's the whole purpose. It's not job. So we can bring out new capacities, new faculties of memory, understanding, judgment, within the human limits, of course. But education implies that we believe that there is a conscious evolution possible within humans. Now, multiply it, concentrate it to a point, nth degree, and you have yoga. So yoga and education are very closely allied. When Mother was asked about how to give this truth and teaching to people who don't believe in God or divine. So that's how she gave the articles on education are a result of that. If you read those articles, it's all about yoga, but without using the word yoga, without using the word divine. When she speaks of the divine, she says something beyond time, space, circumstance, which is not a product of your birth, your circumstances. She liberates you from everything. Similarly in Auroville. So we have that famous Auroville charter. So she invited all the countries. How many? I think 179 countries. Yeah, they were invited. They have put their sand in Auroville. So the Russians refused. They said, we don't believe in divine. Because in the charter, one of the clauses that willing servitors of the divine. Now, divine is a word which, you know, goes beyond all these human limitations. Because God is limited by our understanding. We have constructed a God. But divine is something which is always something beautiful, something high, true. And you can have the gradations of divine. So she asked them, do they believe in perfection? Said, yes. So for them, the mother, you know, when they took the oath, she had used the word, we are willing servitors of the perfect consciousness. So, you know, it's a term which has been, how much she has liberated yoga and spiritual life from all the traditional mindset. So, he roughly describes the step that conscious will means what? It is not, however, by the mental will in man that this can be wholly done. For the mind goes only to a certain point and after that can only move in a circle. So intellectual thought can be preparation. Intellectual thought is like flying machine. It can take you to a point. It can maybe land you in Mars or land you in... But after that you have to get down and go. Or it can take you to a, let's say in pilgrimage we have this, now we have even helicopter services to, I don't know, Badrinath, but Kedarnath they have quite close. Or you have motorable cars, so it can take you till there. But you have to get down and then walk. So thought is like that. Thought can help us to a point. So mental will can take us to a point. It can stretch. But beyond a point it begins to vanish because that's the birthplace of thought. So if you, but he's not saying don't use the thought. But use the thought, know its limitation, it'll take you very far and high, but after that it reaches its own origin. So when it reaches its own origin, and that's what happened in a kind of Vedantic thought, that thought became silent and they thought that it's the end of things. Paradox. Because by the mind you will reach that point, but not beyond. So Sri Aurobindo clarifies that you cannot go beyond it. It'll move in circles, you'll have philosophies, systems, etc. So what is needed? A conversion has to be made, a turning of the consciousness by which mind has to change into the higher principle. So there is something beyond mind which must come and touch it and change it into a higher principle of which we do not know now. The mind doesn't know. So then about the method, he says, the method is to be found through the ancient psychological discipline and practice of yoga. Especially, I would say, Vedanta and the Gita forms a very good basis for Sri Aurobindo's yoga. This is Sri Aurobindo's own words. That if there is a Vedantic background, one reality, it serves as a foundation. And if we have the practice of the Gita, equanimity, nishkam karma, surrender to the divine, then it gives another very solid foundation for Sri Aurobindo's yoga. So this is the foundation. Of course, Sri Aurobindo's yoga goes further. But this is the foundation. In the past, it has been attempted by a drawing away from the world and a disappearance into the height of the self or spirit. So these methods were used to come in contact with that beyond. The mind should come in contact with the beyond. But once it came in contact, it vanished into it. But now the goal changes. Sri Aurobindo teaches that a descent of the higher principle is possible, which will not merely release the spiritual self out of the world, but release it in the world, replace the mind's ignorance or its very limited knowledge by a supramental truth consciousness, which will be a sufficient instrument of the inner self and make it possible for the human being to find himself dynamically as well as inwardly, and grow out of his still animal humanity into a diviner race. So basically the thing is, mind stretches, heart stretches through bhakti yoga, will stretches through karma yoga, and you reach a point beyond which everything becomes quiescent. But then what do? It is used as a door to mukti. You go and merge. But that greater truth into which the mind itself dissolves and the heart dissolves, can that truth and its power not descend here? This was Sri Aurobindo's quest. And he says, yes, it can dissolve, it can enter. And if it can descend, it can change earthly life. So this was Sri Aurobindo and the mother's work to make sure that that power descend. So descent is one of the, again, novel things in this yoga. It's not just ascension by meditation, but a descent of the higher consciousness or the supramental consciousness. So why they? So they were required because first some body or some mind has to be ready to receive that descent and hold it. Otherwise, mind will be shattered, like Yajnavalkya saying to Gargi, that Gargi asked this question, what is beyond the self? And Yajnaval says, Gargi, one more question and your head will burst into 1,000 pieces. Which many anti, you know, feminists who say, see, in India, because he's a man, but it's nothing to do with that. It's because beyond a point you cannot contain. Gargi herself says he knows the truth. He knows that beyond it you cannot speak about it. Because it exceeds, transcends everything. But this truth, if it descends, it can change human mind to contain that infinite wisdom, infinite knowledge. If it descends into the human heart, it can make the heart a receptacle of infinite love and sweetness. If it descends into the human life, it can change human life into that infinite shakti, energy, power, luminous power of the divine. And if it descends in the body, it can transmute the body into a divine body. So first it was their body on which they did the experiment. When they could contain it, then the little circle of people around them. So that's how the ashram got formed. So the ashram was the result of these few sample of humanity on which they started, how they react to this new consciousness. Because they have done a tapasya which we cannot imagine. But humans, how they will respond to this new consciousness. And we know the resistances that came up, the possibilities that opened up, amazing things. That's a whole history. So ashram was always meant to root this consciousness in matter. So the task in the ashram is essentially to make sure that it remains established here. And all the ashram disciples, this is their main purpose. But then this has to also spread into the world because it's also a collective yoga. Collective yoga has two aspects, but we'll talk relatively loosely. It has to reach to the world at large. So the Sri Aurobindo Society and Auroville came into existence. So Sri Aurobindo Society's task was, okay, you don't need to worry about rooting. Ashram is rooting it. You stay connected. And from the ashram, society grew and society became the vehicle for transmission of this truth into the world through mental knowledge, intellectual knowledge, through direct experience, because not everybody can carry it. So at least, you know, to make known to people. Now some from there will come and enter into one of the two, depending on where they stand. And then out of society sprang Auroville. So Auroville was still further outreach where people from all over the world, mother opened the yoga in an amazing way that you don't have to believe in anything. Like for ashram, you have to have faith in Sri Aurobindo and the mother because you cannot practice establishing it is impossible. In Sri Aurobindo, in ashram, faith plus practice. In society, faith. Practice is good, but okay, I mean, you don't have to be so deeply involved in that process. And in Auroville, nothing. You have to just allow. It's a grand experiment. The consciousness is working, opening up doors, creativity is emerging. So these were three. And now, of course, as a result of the supramental action, many centers have come up, which Sri Aurobindo has foreseen in the Life Divine. Many centers, Gnostic centers, Lagras, many things have come up. And they are going to come up. Where people sometimes don't even use the word Sri Aurobindo and the mother, that's okay. But they are working towards something very similar. Individuals are coming up who are having a similar idea. So that's the next last step of the supramental evolution. But always you will need the ashram as the central influence. That's how Sri Aurobindo put it and the mother said. That ashram will always maintain its role as the central influence. And everything else radiates. So there have to be people who are committed fully, head to toe, fully, that this is what our life is. So ashram is a place for complete consecration. And because they will be here in material bodies to hold that force, it's not easy. People in the ashram know it very well. Yeah. It's not easy to live here, but nobody wants to leave here. So, you know, I'll put it, you were asking this question. It's not easy to live here because it breaks all your nostrums, your conventions, your ways, forms of belief, thought, everything shatters because it's a force from the beyond. But if you ask, do you want to leave it? No, because there is a delight in that process. Every time it breaks, there is a release, there is a freedom, a liberation, which is, you know, if you take the Buddhist discipline and others, it takes so much time just to be freed from mental conceptions, conditioning. It just breaks you. And then the change begins. The change itself is not easy to. So this is how these organizations have to be seen. Each has its own place, each connected to the mother, each interconnected, where ashram is the root, the society is like the trunk, and Auroville is like the branches, and individuals are like the fruits and flowers. It doesn't matter wherever they are, if they are practicing yoga, but they are drawing from the same roots. So this is the, and the mother and Shobindo are themselves the ground, the soil which is sustaining this process. So this is where we have this connection. Then, this however cannot be done at once or in a short time or by any rapid or miraculous transformation. It's not a 10-day course. It's not a crash course into nirvana or, you know, Guruji take $1,000 and teach you some method. No. Let's be clear. Evolution is a long process, complex process, because it involves the entire human apparatus. It's not like mind is evolving but heart can afford to have its own way, or the heart is evolving but life can follow its own way, or the life is evolving but body will remain like a sloth. No. Especially the body and the lower vital offers tremendous resistance. So it's a long process. In this entire process of evolution, at one point, Sri Aurobindo spoke of 1,000 years, that I am establishing the consciousness. Now the process of evolution will take 1,000 years. Mother cut it short to 300. You can imagine that and all that will happen in between. So many steps have to be taken by the seeker before the supramental descent is possible. He is using the word descent because that time the descent has not taken place. After 29th February 1956, that this sentence changes, because now the descent has taken place and the manifestation is taking place. So that's why Sri Aurobindo used the word 1,000 years, but Mother compressed it to 300 years and she said, if you have the aspiration, it can be further compressed. So this little bit which we find is because Sri Aurobindo was not assuming anything. He is not like somebody who is giving all kinds of assurances, ah, Babaji ke paas, you come and everything will happen, bacha, no. So that time you will see in Sri Aurobindo, he is always cautioning, because it didn't descend in earth consciousness till 1950. 55th December, first time we see the descent for which Sri Aurobindo left his body in matter. And then 56 we see the manifestation. That's why he left it to the mother, because he said that your body is more prepared, much more prepared than mine, and which is understandable. So this is the logic of the transformation. It's going to take long. One has to have perseverance, great degree of endurance, faith to go through the process, and many steps. And he just showing us the mirror. Those who want to have a magical transformation by a 10-day course. So, man lives mostly in his surface mind, life and body. So we are not even aware of our own depths, inner being, soul. We are still with WhatsApp mein pad liya, toh God, if you have read on WhatsApp, some few ideas and you become a Gita Gyani. The essential Gita, and what is there? Gita ka sar. Jo hua achha, achha hua. Jo hoga, achha hoga. So, you know, chill. Basically, it's like saying chill, because everything is happening. Well, it's a very profound truth, but if you misapply it, otherwise Sri Krishna would not have asked Arjun to fight. He would have said, you know what, Arjun, all is good, you chill, I'll do everything. But that's not the case. So he says, man is living in the surface mind. That's why there is so much confusion around all these spiritual teachings, because from the surface mind, we can never understand it. We have to at least have an inner life to begin with. For it is only a very restricted influence from it, the inner being, that he receives now, and that pushes him to a constant pursuit of greater beauty, harmony, power and knowledge. So the surface mind is not aware, but something from within is driving us, taking us to places, taking us to books, taking us. In doing so, he discovers in himself his true soul. This is the first solid step to discover the soul. It's not just, you know, that there is a dehi inside, na jayate mriyate va kadachin. You have to discover that soul as you see something written on the wall. That's how the soul should be visible, tangible, livable. One should live in the soul. So this is the first step. So he says one has to discover the soul. Which he says is soul, which is not this outer mixture of mental, vital and physical elements, but something of the reality behind them. A spark from the one divine fire. That's how he's describing the soul. He has to learn to live in his soul and purify and orientate by its drive toward the truth the rest of the nature. This is the psychic transformation. Basically, we should live in the soul and with the soul, not by the surface consciousness. This is the first requirement, first step. Then there can follow afterwards an opening upward and descent of a higher principle of the being. So that's the spiritualization, higher ranges of consciousness. So his cognition begins to change into more intuitive cognition. The nature of love begins to undergo a change in his heart. The life force, it begins to undergo a change, and so on and so forth. For there are several ranges of consciousness between the ordinary human mind and the supramental truth consciousness. These intervening ranges have to be opened up and their power brought down into the mind, life and body. Only afterwards can the full power of the truth consciousness work in the nature. Now this too has undergone a change, because mother was asked about this. So she said, now that the supermind is already active, manifested, so it's not necessary that it will act in one particular way. So in the beginning, so Sri Aurobindo was not that you have to make ascent through different ranges, higher mind, illumined mind, intuitive mind, over mind, then supermind. But when the supermind started manifesting, then people asked the mother, is it still necessary or it can act in other ways? He says, now that the supermind is manifested, you cannot tie it to any particular logic or any particular method. So it's not that, you know, something of that compressed stage will come. But it's not the classical way that mother has explained that, which is logical because now it is already operating. So it's like when you have the latest Windows, you don't have to go back to learn that, you know, how many of us grew. I am not qualified to speak about it, but what was it? DOS. Then what was Linux or whatever. Then Windows came, so different upgraded Windows. Now if you have the latest, so you don't have to go back and learn all the Windows. It's inbuilt in the system. So in the human consciousness, and many things have happened subsequently, this new supramental chip, if you may say so, is now ingrained. So it's operating, it is bypassing all these requirements. But naturally, Shobindo's letter is before that. I think this letter is in 30s, 36 or something. And then he says, there is a purification required. By purification means all the old sanskars, old ways of thinking. Here purification is not about moral purification or living according to social standard or religious law. That if you don't, you don't have to eat this thing and you have to go on a onion-free diet. None of this. It's not about that purification. But it's not achar shuddhi as we understand. But not even vichar shuddhi as we understand. But this purification is a complete reorientation. That's why he uses the word reorientation. This purification means to come under the divine influence. For instance, why not vichar shuddhi? Vichar shuddhi, oh, I should not harbor any kind of, you know, thought of violence. It's true, but you may be called upon in military. So what do I do? So if you go by the pure vichar shuddhi, you are not supposed to fight. But a yogi driven by the God impulse, without, it will bypass this, and even when he is in the battle, he will experience something of that divine truth. So this is the difference that Sri Aurobindo is reminding us. So this purification is a far more difficult process than the usual yama niyama and the other purifications. There are many things belonging to older systems that are necessary on the way. So many people ask this, that, you know, it is like any other yoga. No, not exactly, but you will see. It's like after higher secondary, people branch out into different fields, or even before that, when they enter into, you know, when they have to select this line or that line. So there is a point up till which things are common. For instance, conquest of desire, ego self, this is common to every yogic system. either exhausted by indulging in it, that's another way some people have tried, or exhausted by completely withdrawing from it, whatever way. So there are common elements, that means conquest of desire, conquest of the ego, ambition, all this one has to get over. So he says there are common things, and opening of the mind to a greater wideness and to the sense of the self and the infinite, which we find in Vedanta. An emergence into what has been called the cosmic consciousness, some yogas have that. Mastery over the desires and passions, and outward asceticism is not essential. But the conquest of desire and attachment and a control over the body and its needs, greeds and instincts is indispensable. So we see in the ashram life organized like that. So there is this outward asceticism is not there. So nobody puts on a girva vastra or a white vastra or anything like that. They are regular people, as they say. But concealed behind the regular facade may be a not just a nascent yogi, but a fully developed one, fairly developed one. But you will not get to know. Nobody will, Yogi Maharaj aa rahe hain, like we had that, you know, Shankaracharya ji coming and with all the Kshatra Puja and all. You will not know, because this is not a yoga of asceticism. Again, in the ashram dining room food, so you don't have to be ascetic, but if you have dining room food, you develop automatically. Getting rid of that greed and all this. You work in the ashram department, you will get rid of all this ambition that, you know, there is no power, there is no position. There is no head swami and swamiji below him, or, you know, the senior swami or the lesser swami. All are sadhak, they are given work, not position. There is a letter of the mother. I give work, I do not give positions. So, you know, the ashram life is meant to automatically get us rid of all this. There is a knowledge through the mind's discernment between reality and the appearance, the heart's way of devotion, love and surrender, and the way of works, turning the will away from motives of self-interest to the truth and the service of a greater reality than the ego. So all these are common elements in every yoga. Here too they are necessary. And then he speaks about the master, and that he has given in detail. Master is within. And of course we have many things. The samadhi itself is there. So the return to this place of central influence. So repeatedly Shurbindo says that wherever you may be, you should keep coming to receive the central influence and then go. So that you can be, you know, he has used the word charging the battery. So come here, receive this input, influx, and then go into the world. And of course if one can live here, then of course that's a wonderful grace. And then what is this February 1934. And of course, we see later on that constant refrain of Sri Aurobindo, open to the mother, open to the mother. That's the easiest way, because she's embodying that consciousness. So by just opening to her, the yoga keeps getting done. And finally, very, very importantly, this is Sri Aurobindo's teaching and method of practice. He has given in a nutshell. It's a summary statement. It is not his object to develop any one religion or to amalgamate the older religions or to found any new religion, for any of these things would lead away from his central purpose. So he was very clear, no religion, no sect, no cult, and so much so that for Auroville specifically he said no religion, no these ideologies, this all this will distract from the purpose. That's why he made it so vast, so vast. So, and in fact the mother said it will be harmful for his purpose. If you develop a new religion with certain codes of conduct, ritual practices, you know, then you will, you're going to distract. When people go to the ashram, there is no compulsion. Whether you bow, you don't bow, you take an agarbatti, you don't take an agarbatti. Flowers too are prohibited, it is the only place. Whether you put an offering, because otherwise people put chaotically. The purpose is that they just bring flowers with a desire and put it like this. So they have prohibited for this reason, that keep the beauty of the arrangement at least. If you want agarbatti, there are non-toxic agarbatti made in the ashram. But there is no compulsion of any kind. You can stand there just like this watching, or you can bow down at the samadhi. And there are people who have even gone there to the samadhi and asked somebody, where are the t-shirts sold? So, you know, nobody teaches you what to do, nobody dictates anything to you, and it, yeah, go to sleep, yes, nothing, it's beautiful. When someone asked Sri Aurobindo what is the best method of meditation, no, rather she asked, one lady, Sahanadi, I don't know how to meditate, but when I sit for meditation, I imagine my head in the mother's lap, which people actually used to do when they went to meet the mother. So Sri Aurobindo writes, this is the best possible form of meditation. Now, can you imagine meditation removed from all trappings? Ab baithe ho, maa ke god mein aapne sir rakha hua hai. Ye nahi ki ab isko bhi ek aapne defined, you turn it into a ritual, okay, everybody will sit. Now imagine that the mother's lap, putting your head, no. It's because people can turn anything into a religion or a cult. So this is what he beautifully explains. In fact, he says that turning it into a new religion will be harmful to the teaching. And he says that it means hundreds of thousands of all kinds of people will join and distract it from the true purpose. There is a letter where he says, I do not believe in advertisement or propaganda except for medicine and patent medicine and politics. And then he says, but for a work, serious work like mine, it will be a poison. It's a serious work. So this idea, call everybody, convert everybody, turn everybody, nobody. If you feel impelled, you will come. Nobody can stop you then. And if you don't feel, you are going through different layers of humanity, going through different stages of preparation, it's fine. So nobody tries to convert or say, no, no, this guru is greater. Your guru is not so good. Nothing. That's how Sri Aurobindo and the mother have trained us, and this place speaks of that. The one aim of his yoga is an inner self-development by which, and there also a lot of freedom, not like standard way. So nobody is there to teach you this method of meditation. Everything is there in Sri Aurobindo's works. If you read through Letters on Yoga, every kind of meditation, you can make a 300 pages worth of book only on meditation. The methods and what meditation is, what is the best way, Sri Aurobindo and the mother has spoken about it. But equally they have written that if you do work with the true attitude, you don't need meditation. Then there is all this about work, the true attitude in work. They'll form another 300, 400 pages. Then he says that bhakti is another crown. If you love the divine, love the mother, remember, know that the mother loves you. So he's not tied us to any one form or formula. It's up to each one's stage of growth, natural temperament, just like in Sanatana Dharma, your predilection and destiny. The one aim of his yoga is an inner self-development by which each one who follows it can in time discover the one self in all and evolve a higher consciousness than the mental, a spiritual and supramental consciousness which will transform and divinize human nature. So everybody who is on the path has to different degrees his own set of experiences. Somebody once asked Chote Narayan ji, kya hota hai, kuch hota bhi hai, does something happen? He says, he was a master in every possible spiritual literature, left and right. Professor in English, used to speak in English and Hindi. So, kisi ne Hindi mein pucha, kya karte hain aap log itne saal? Because there is nothing like, you can't see any visible, tangible thing ki log baith ke meditate kar rahe hain, bhajan kar rahe hain, kirtan kar rahe hain, Swami ji satsang kar rahe hain, kuch bhi nahi hai. To kisi ne pucha unse, I'll say in Hindi then translate in English, ki kya karte hain aap log, kya hota hai? Khali hum dekhte hain ki samadhi par ja kar ke aap pathar par sir rakh rahe hain. तो उन्होंने छोटा नारायण जी वॉज सो इरिटेट, कहते हैं आप समझते हैं कि हम लोग मूर्ख हैं क्या जो पत्थर पे माथा फोड़ रहे हैं? इज स्टाइल ऑफ सेइंग यू थिंक वी आर फूल्स, दैट वॉज हिज वे ऑफ रिस्पॉन्डिंग. आफ्टर ऑल देर आर पीपल हु हैव लेफ्ट बिहाइंड गॉड नोज व्हाट नॉट. वन ऑफ माई एक्सपीरियंसिस वॉज इन इंटरनेशनल गेस्ट हाउस. आई वेंट देयर एंड देयर वॉज अ मैन सिटिंग इन बनियान एंड निकर. सो कैजुअली पूछा, यू नो कौन, तो यू आर सिटिंग आउटसाइड ऑन स्टूल एंड ही पॉइंटेड आउट देयर. लेटर ऑन आई केम टू नो ही वाज अ रिटायर्ड जज ऑफ द सुप्रीम कोर्ट. There was this general, even General Tiwari, who fought in the Bangladesh war as an instrument of the mother. And of course, General Banerjee, who would laughingly say, they have made me general, he used to share his joke with me. Major, they have made me major, because people here didn't know. They thought general means general category. So, unko laga ki major they have heard, major saab, their films also. So, they would call him major, thinking that by calling him general, unka apman hoga. So, when he used to share, he says, dekho mere saath kya karte hain, mazak mazak mein. To maine kaha, achha hai na, aapko vinamrata sikha di. To kehte, haan, haan, wo to hai. So, there are people, if you go into it, my first impression when I came here and I attended a study camp, Vijay Bhai, I remember having heard Vijay Bhai. I said, Vijay Bhai, it seems a place packed with geniuses. That was my impression. Who are these people? They are extraordinary people. But they go in modest appearance. All of them are having their own set of experiences, which now there are books, interviews in which people have spoken. You'll find many of these interviews, which are amazing, which can form a Veda in its own right. And none of this external tamjham or outer trapping. So this is the place. Let me close with this last sentence. This is Shurbindo's teaching and method of practice. It is not his object to develop any one religion or to amalgamate the older religions or to found any new religion, for any of these things would lead away from his central purpose. The one aim of his yoga is an inner self-development by which each one who follows it can in time discover the one self in all and evolve a higher consciousness than the mental, a spiritual and supramental consciousness which will transform and divinize human nature. Chema, so.